Oh, good evening. We talked about all dharmas are marked with emptiness last week. I have the handout. Some of you weren't here, I think. Somebody keep this one. A very nice one. And I made a mistake with it. I went back and looked at Red Pine again, and what I said was that there were when they were trying to work out what we're made of, what the world is made of, that was really the effort, trying to figure out what this is. And so they said form, feeling, perception, impulses, consciousness for a human being, that's one way of analyzing how things are. And then if you go farther, you say, well, everything is a thing or a dharma. The dharma is whatever we can perceive with this little sort of perception business that we are. And so when they started analyzing it, they decided that although every dharma was empty, there was a tiny bit of not empty in every dharma. Not just some of them, but all of them. So they couldn't quite let go of things. They couldn't quite let it just be empty. So they said, well, there's this mark on each thing, a kind of essence that continues through time, that's eternal, that never ends. That's really going back to the old Hindu idea of Atman being in Atman being in everything, that this little bit of God is in each person and by extrapolation in each thing that the person experiences. But when the Mahayana began to study the whole situation and say, what is the world made of and how are we operating in the world, how does this all work, they realized that you can't say that. That actually all dharmas are empty. That everything is completely interchangeable with everything else. That the chair becomes firewood, the firewood becomes gas in the air that goes up and then comes down in some other form, and everything is moving and changing all the time. All the people, all the things, all the stuff. There's nothing that stays. Nothing. That's what emptiness means. So, Buddha's notion was that the fundamental entity of mind, of human, are the three marks of existence. That it's impermanent and marked with suffering and with no self. No permanent, lasting self. So, if you experience that, then you have to say that all dharmas are empty. We too. But you can turn it around and say that if everything is connected and everything a part of everything else, then nothing is impermanent. It's all in the same time. that it's all one huge piece of time, and that how we know each other is by each other. We define our own condition and self nature by our relationship to everything else. We don't know who we are except in relation to others. In fact, if we carry it all the way, we have to say that we are others, or others are us. That's how intimately connected we are, how dynamically connected we are. So, the original arhats wanted to cut off all attachments in order to transcend all of this. And clear up the self and purify it. And the Mahayanas said, as we know from Huineng, no, the mirror isn't full of dust. Actually, there's no mirror and there is no dust. That if you see clearly, you can see clear through all the attachments, and it's all just as it is. Just as it is right now. So, now I have two more handouts. Because the next thing is, all things are marked with emptiness. Let's see. They do not appear nor disappear, are not tainted nor pure, do not increase nor decrease. So I'm giving you a monster. I bet you have that one, Donalyn. Oh, really? Another one? I've done this several times. I have this huge folder and I keep rewriting it over and over again. Thank you. Did you get one?
Not yet.
Thank you. So when that we say no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path, that's what this is. This is the path. Suffering, or, no, that's Buddha's Four Noble Truths. It's before that. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of eyes, and so forth, until no realm of mind consciousness. No ignorance, and also no extinction of it, and so forth. And this is the end, so forth, this circle, until no old age and death. So ignorance causes, formative forces, they're called here, which causes consciousness. With consciousness comes naming, actually finding shape in the world. With that comes all of our sensation as we begin to experience the world. The world comes to birth in us in this way. This is the description of how it happens that we know something. And then with the sense fields alive and awake, we have contact. We actually are touched by things. And then we feel. And then we start to want. So craving arises, and grasping then arises. And from grasping, becoming, we become someone. Someone who wants something or doesn't want something. And then from that, a person is born. And from that person, of course, it falls apart, because everything falls apart. And it starts all over again. So you can see this in a lot of different ways. You can see this as a psychological, every moment kind of process that we go through as we become aware of something, and then it goes all the way through as we agree with ourselves to actually experience it, and then the experience dies and we wake up to something else. Or in the case of this picture, it's about human life itself. And from birth we are born in ignorance and go through this long series of sufferings, driven by what's in the middle, which is hard to see. There's a snake and a rooster and a pig in there, in the very center. And that's the pig is greed. No, the pig is ignorance, I think. The rooster is greed, and the snake is anger. And the pig is ignorance. I think that's the three poisons, they call them. Yeah.
The next is five or six.
So the first turning of the wheel of Buddha's teaching was the Four Noble Truths, which come next. We'll talk about that next week. And this is the second one. This is another way that he tried to explain emptiness to his followers. He had an experience of emptiness, and then he tried in a very logical, careful way to try to characterize it for people so that they could experience it also. The monster, the red monster that's holding this in its claws, is time. So as long as we're caught in this endless round, we're caught by time. There's no way off this wheel except as a human being, they say. That otherwise, animals can't do it, hungry ghosts can't do it, even the heavenly realm can't get off this wheel. They like it too much in the heavenly realm, they don't even want to get off. So the only ones who have the kind of insight to know what it is that they're in is the human mind. This is metaphorical, of course, but it seems pretty true. We have a choice how we see.
Andy,
yes?
What's the heavenly realm? You said even the heavenly realm, too much.
Well, they divide life into six realms. The hell realm, the hungry ghost realm, the animal realm, the fighting warriors, the human realm, and the heavenly realm. So again, you can see it in psychological terms as the different states of mind that we fall into. Or you can see it as a kind of typology for how everything is sorted out, and there are animals, and there are, you know, hellish existences, and so it makes sense in that way also. So the heavenly realm is where everything is fine. It's so fine that people don't want to change. And I know people that way who have everything that they possibly need and are very happy just the way they are. And it is a kind of heavenly realm. But it's also a kind of ignoring at the same time.
So why do they call it heavenly?
Well, it's not the same kind of heaven as the Christian heaven. It's just a really, really, really nice place that nobody wants to leave. But they always have to leave. You never can stay. You always evolve into some other.
So you're not talking about different planets?
No.
It's all here.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, it's a way of trying to understand what's here, what this is.
And the dead, where do the dead fall in this?
They're just dead.
Okay. So they're not a part of this or spirits?
No. No.
So this is also called the Wheel of Life?
Yes.
So the 12, and then, so the 12 wheels of causation, Wheel of Life.
Or Pratichutsamutpada in Sanskrit. The Buddha said, if you see Pratichutsamutpada, if you can see this, the way it's all fitted together, you'll see me, he said.
Who said that?
Buddha.
I thought God or Jesus said that.
Well, he did sort of, actually. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, that's another way of talking about it. Dependent origination, so everything arises from everything else.
And the Hinayana, they also have this symbol, don't they? Don't they also work with this model?
Yes, but their intention is different. And their intention is to step off the wheel and never come back.
Yes.
And to them, that's what nirvana is in terms of arhat practice. And Mahayana's idea or intention, bodhisattva intention, is to stay here.
Right.
And as Koban says, once you see what it is, the whole thing turns to gold. So as they sometimes say, samsara is nirvana. It's not someplace else, it's right here. It's how we experience it. So it's a matter of studying what our ignorance is, basically. Because that's the basis of it. And Koban has some things about that in the handout. Essentially, ignorance is the absence of light. So, vidya is the word for light, and avidya is no light. So we were talking about that last week, or I guess Saturday, when we were talking about shining. Koban says, talks about the five hindrances, which are the things that keep us from shining. And there are five survival modes of food, sleep, sex, shelter, and being known, being famous. And as long as we're hooked by those, you can see they're absolutely essential. We cannot live without any of those. And yet, they're what hook us and keep us from seeing, keep us from the light. So it's about attachment to survival in a way. It's about a basic insecurity that keeps us always kind of holding on when we don't need to. So it comes down to, in practice, to trust. As we know. And so in Zazen, in order to sit, we have to trust that the ground, that the floor is going to hold us, and that we're not going to fall off the cushion, and that the breath will come and go, that all things are well. And as we practice, we're really training ourselves to understand that is true everywhere. That no ignorance means trust. Trusting that how we are is how it's supposed to be. So maybe that's enough. Are there questions about either one of those?
When you're comparing the Mahayana, the this, the that, well, they, you know, mean it differently. So we know that. And well, it does matter, but how do you practice it? Do you question why, or does it make sense to her but not to you, or?
I had a lot of trouble with this. It took me a long time to understand what it was talking about. And I think the understanding comes from practice. And also from being honest with oneself. You know, it's hard to face your own ignorance. At least it was for me. I mean, on a superficial level, of course, we can say, yeah, of course, that's the way. And we're all like that, and we have to understand. But to really, to live into your own life and know it the way it arises and falls and lives and falls and dies, it takes a lot of courage and a lot of work. And that's what he's talking about. I mean, we do hold on. We hold on very tight in ways that are impeding ourselves. We just are getting in our own way by this little thing in the middle of us that's so anxious, basically.
But when you said, like, I don't remember who it was, that their idea is to get off the wheel, and Colvin was saying,
yeah,
to stay in it. So does it really matter if whoever wants to get off the wheel, but it's really studying and experiencing it, whether he's on the wheel or off the wheel, does it matter where they are, as long as, I mean, we believe if we sit, anybody, whether they're Christian or Buddhist, it doesn't matter who the heck it is, if they're honestly studying for truth,
Yes.
They will find it.
Absolutely. Yes.
So why do we care whether they meant, and I'm not trying to put down.
No, no, I understand. I understand.
Because sometimes I feel so under knowledge or whatever you want to say with the Dharma or whatever you want to call it.
In the old days, after Buddha died, Buddhism developed. It developed several different schools, and the schools became monastic. So they were living in the monasteries and became more and more ingrown. And the intention of the monks was to transcend this wheel and get out of life and never come back. I don't know exactly what how they thought of nirvana as burning out or burning up in a way, so there would be nothing left. And it became perceived as a problem by some monks, Shantideva being one of the first, who said, but what about everybody else? Why are we closing ourselves up in here, staring at a wall, and doing all this for ourselves? When people are out there suffering, they're hungry, they're cold, they don't know anything about this teaching. Why are we doing this? And so some of them decided that maybe there was more to Buddha's teaching than that, and they should rededicate their life to the benefit of all beings. So that was what the change was. So the Hinayana is the wrong word anyway. It just means little. And it wasn't little. It was a very large movement, and it's still going on. But it's Theravadin is really what it is now. But there is that the distinction of intention. And, of course, the Theravadins are extremely generous and very eager to cultivate and help all beings as well. So it's really, Mahayana always makes this division, because I think it must have been hard to step out in the way that they did. And so thousands of years later, we're still making a distinction because we did that hard thing. But it only means that the intention is the bodhisattva intention. But it's a real good question, Soumya.
I just recently read an article by Gil Fronsdale about this, but in his version is the way I asked the question. I think it's, and he calls it the 12 links, I think, of cessation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, which, again, it's all the same. At one point I asked Gil when I had a chance, because Gil practiced in our same tradition, and now he practices in the Theravada tradition. And you know Gil, he's the founding and resident teacher at Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City. And so I said to him, I go, this is all very confusing, you know, just like you're asking, you know. And because he had changed, like he went to Thailand, then he came back and practiced, or in Japan, and then, you know, he changed schools. And so now he teaches the Theravada. And I kind of asked him a question, well, what led to that, or how, you know, how important is the differences? Isn't it just a matter of the sitting? And he said, yeah. He said that it's all the Dharma. It's just the cup that we hold it in. And I always liked that.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you said, it's all the same. It's just words trying to express. Our bodhisattva, I guess, ideal vow, it is a distinction, because we do, you know, make that every time in our service.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And that's what we were talking about. In fact, you were asking about on Saturday. about saving all beings. That's the turning place right there. Do we practice just for ourselves, or do we practice for all?
So I asked the same question again 2 days later.
No, you asked a further question to elucidate the first question. That was a very good move, I think. Makes things even more clear. There are an awful lot of words about this. Maybe I gave you too many words. I'm looking at this thinking, oh. but it's also very interesting. It's one way of talking about it is karma, which we all have heard since the 60s in a lot. It doesn't mean that we're destined or fated for one thing or another. You can look at this as karmic. This is the wheel that keeps affecting, and karma is an action. Each action affects the next action. But each thing is so complicated and affected by so many other things that we can't really trace where we came from in karma. We can determine for ourselves as well as we can where we're going. That we can do. And so our understanding of karma is important from that point of view, not to figure out who we are in some kind of, you know, I was the Queen of Sheba thousands of years ago or something, but how to take our next step and not make a mess. And how to let how we came here carry us into the next step. So in that sense, it's a very wonderful way of seeing how we go. It's always moving, always going. But we can always decide. We're always choosing. Well, it's 8. So thank you.